Good day and welcome to Letters on Politics. I'm Mitch Jezrich. In this year's presidential election, the number that really matters comes from the Electoral College. There are 538 Electoral College votes available, and a candidate must receive 270 of them to win. Electoral College votes given to each state mostly corresponds to the number of representatives that each state has in Congress, though the District of Columbia is given 3 Electoral College votes, even though they have no representatives. That's a story for another day. In most states, but not all, the candidate that wins the popular vote in each state receives all of that state's Electoral College vote. California has the most Electoral College votes with 55. Texas has 38, and both Florida and New York have 29. So why do we have an Electoral College anyways? Well, it's enshrined in the United States Constitution, and perhaps the best and easiest way to understand why we have it is the protection of the institution of slavery. For more on that history, I'm joined by Akhil Reed Amar. He is the Sterling Professor of Law and Political Science at Yale University. He's the author of a number of books on the U.S. Constitution, several books which he has been on this very radio program to talk about in the past. His latest is a collection of essays that he has written over the years. It's called The Constitution Today, Timeless Lessons for the Issues of Our Era. He joins us from the studios of Yale University. Okay, Akhil Reed Amar, and we're going to talk about other issues about the Constitution as well, because you go through many of them in your latest book. But I've always been fascinated, and here we are in a presidential election, about the Electoral College. Before we get into the issue of slavery, though, let's talk about what it actually is. Can you tell us more about what the Constitution says about the Electoral College? And I guess we're talking about Article 2 of the Constitution, which deals with executive power. In other words, lays out what the presidency is.
It does. And we're also talking about an early amendment to the original Constitution, the 12th Amendment, that modifies the Electoral College. So here's how the system emerged from the Philadelphia Convention in 1787. Each state is given a certain number of electoral votes, and the state legislature determines how those electoral votes are to be apportioned. In theory, the state legislature could pick the there's a series of electors that the state has to pick, and the state legislature could pick them in theory, but very early on, most of the state legislatures actually allow the citizens, the populace, to vote, but the state legislature determines how that's going to work. Is it going to be winner take all? Is it going to be winner take most? Is it going to be by district? Again, early on, state legislatures themselves picked electors, and the number of electors that each state gets corresponds initially to the number of representatives in the House of Representatives plus 2 senators for each state. The electors are picked. They meet in their respective states all on a single day. And so you see, actually, it doesn't say Electoral College, and it's not really very collegial because they don't really have time to deliberate with each other. They have to actually vote in a day. From the beginning, they're basically potted plants. They're pre-selected. They're told what to do by the people who pick them. But the electors vote in their respective states. The votes are then sent to the national capital. At a certain point, the votes are opened up in Congress, and the winner is announced. And that's the original Philadelphia system, but it actually gets changed by the 12th Amendment. But let me tell you one other thing about the original Philadelphia system. Under the original system, each elector casts 2 votes for 2 different people, one of whom has to be from a state not his own. For example, in the first election, every single elector casts 1 vote, their main vote basically, for George Washington, but then a whole bunch of other people get votes also, because you have to count, each elector has to count 2 votes, and the person who comes in second for the presidency under the original vision automatically becomes vice president. In the first 2 elections, the person who came in second was John Adams, and so he became vice president. But you didn't vote for him for vice president.
He came in
you
second.
You voted for him, second in the vote. Every single elector cast 1 of their votes for George Washington, and then their second choice votes, in effect, were scattered. But technically, they weren't designated as second choice votes. They weren't designated as vice presidential votes. They were just 2 votes for president.
Now, I have 2 questions I want to ask you before we even get to the 12th Amendment. to the Constitution that changes us a little bit. The role of the state legislatures in deciding how each state would pick electoral college votes, could it have gone a different direction, and maybe in the direction that the state legislatures played in picking senators before that was put to the vote?
It's a very nice analogy, Mitch, because early on, the state legislatures formally pick United States senators. Now the Constitution has been amended so that the voters pick them. But there was a time in between when, although state legislatures formally pick senators, they in effect took their cue, their advice from the citizenry. They structured ballots in which ordinary voters would vote informally for whom they really wanted to be their U.S. senator, and then the state legislature would sort of ratify the result of that informal popular vote, that beauty contest. So even if the state legislature formally does the picking, you could imagine a system in which they kind of leave it up to the voters. In just that way, but even earlier with the Electoral College, most state legislatures from a very early moment, basically, although they had a right, if they wanted to pick the electors themselves, they turfed that out to the citizenry. And once sister states are doing it, you look kind of bad if you're a state legislature and you don't do it because your voters say, why don't you trust us? You know, state A on one side of us, trust the voters. State B on the other side of us, trust the voters. Why don't you trust your voters, Mr. Legislature?
Were founders and the people that adopted the U.S. Constitution at the 1787 convention, were they wary of direct democracy?
That's the standard view. It's associated with the most famous book on the Constitution from the 20th century, a book by Charles Beard called An Economic Interpretation of the Constitution. It's the sort of the leftist view of Howard Zinn, who was very famously mentioned in Good Will Hunting. It's the view put forth more recently by scholars such as Woody Holton and most recently, Michael Klarman in a new book. He's a professor at Harvard Law School, called The Framers' Coup. I have a different view. I think they say the framers of the Constitution really didn't believe in democracy. Democracy is a dirty word. They were trying to protect the property interests and the creditors against the unwashed masses, the farmers with pitchforks who wanted debtor relief laws and paper money and redistribution and all that stuff. That's the Beard, Zinn, Woody Holton, Mike Klarman view. My view is, wait a minute, guys. They put the Constitution to a vote. It says we the people, which they hadn't done with the Articles of Confederation or most state constitutions or the Declaration of Independence. Wait a minute. In that vote, in 8 out of the 13 states, property qualifications to vote on the Constitution were lowered or eliminated compared to what they were for ordinary elections. Wait a minute. They created a House of Representatives that was directly elected, which you didn't have under the Articles of Confederation. Wait a minute. There are no property qualifications to be a member of the House or the Senate or president for that matter. So, and democracy, by the way, wasn't a dirty word because Thomas Jefferson creates, along with James Madison, and we're going to get to this very shortly, I hope, in our conversation, a political party, and they call themselves the Democratic Republicans. And if it's a dirty word, why would you call your party Democrats? And that's going to become Andrew Jackson's Democrat Party. So I think the standard story that they didn't believe in democracy is overstated.
I want to get to this issue of political parties too, and that gets us again to what you were talking about earlier, Akhil Reed Omar. Originally, before the 12th Amendment to the United States Constitution, whoever came in second in the Electoral College vote became the vice president.
Right.
That's because the founders were hoping or were at least against the idea of having political parties.
Exactly so, Mitch, because think about it. In a world where you have Clinton against Trump at each other's throats, and one's going to come in first and one's going to come in second for the presidency, would you want the person who came in second to be a heartbeat away?
Let me ask you this. Was it a two-party system then, though? I mean, before parties?
Well, in a regime where there are two parties that don't like each other so much and have very different views, that system, in that world, world, it's an assassination, in a sense, of waiting to happen. Just, you like number two, but there's number one in the way, but if you can just bump him off or something. They weren't expecting the emergence of two parties, because remember what I told you before, every single elector votes for George Washington. So everyone knew he would be the first president if Virginia ratified the Constitution. So they weren't initially expecting that America would very quickly basically divide into a left and a right, with two different views of government and views of the world. Originally, everyone coordinated around George Washington. And it was only when Washington left the scene that political parties, two kind of factions, emerge, one led by Thomas Jefferson, one led by John Adams. And when they emerge, it begins to dawn on people that we're beginning to see the beginning of a two-party system, and the rules that we created for our original Electoral College don't make sense. And concretely, here's why they don't make sense. Jefferson and Adams, they used to be friends. They had coordinated. They'd worked together on the Declaration of Independence. But now they have kind of different worldviews once Washington leaves the scene. Adams is a more conservative guy. He leans toward Britain, which is a monarchy. Jefferson's a more liberal guy. He leans toward France, which has become after the Revolution, a more radically democratic place. And when they run against each other, once Washington leaves the scene, in 1796, it's somewhat tame. Jefferson tells his pals, listen, don't badmouth Adams too much. He's my elder. My turn will come. And Adams comes in first, Jefferson second. Okay. But then things happen in Europe that really polarize American politics. Adams moves to the right. Jefferson moves to the left. This is the sitting president and the sitting vice president, and now they hate each other.
What are we talking about in Europe? Are we talking about, what, the French Revolution?
The French Revolution and the English response to the French Revolution. Exactly so. And again, Adams is increasingly aligned with British monarchy, and Jefferson increasingly with French radicalism. And Adams signs a law, the Sedition Act, part of the Alien Sedition Act. He's targeting aliens, sound like anyone you know. And he's targeting free speech, sound like anyone you know. And that law makes it a crime to criticize the president. It makes it a crime to criticize the Congress, which is controlled by Adams' party. It is not a crime to criticize the vice president, Thomas Jefferson. And indeed, the people who are prosecuted under that sedition law are basically Jefferson's pals. So Adams, in effect, is criminalizing Jefferson and his friends and the opposition, and now the sitting vice president of the United States runs against the sitting president in a rematch in 1800, and now it's not a tame affair. It's for all the marbles, but once again, the framer system, has been shown to not work so well, because in a world where there are intense political parties, it makes no sense to say the guy who comes in second for the presidency should be the vice president. So now we're going to
need to really watch your back.
create a system in which basically you can run on a ticket. You can have the one party, the conservative party, that will say, here's our candidate for president and here's our number two guy for vice president. And the leftist party can do the same thing. And what happens is, when Adams eventually loses to Jefferson, the Constitution is amended. It's called the 12th Amendment. And that's, in fact, our Electoral College system, in which the electors don't cast two votes for the presidency, but one vote for a president, one vote for a vice president, and we have political parties basically with tickets. Trump, Pence, and everyone understands Trump is president, the presidential candidate. Pence is the vice presidential candidate. Clinton, Kaine. That's what the 12th Amendment makes possible.
Again, we are in conversation with Akhil Reed Amar. He is the author of the book, The Constitution Today, Timeless Lessons for the Issues of Our Era. We are in conversation about the Electoral College system, as well as other constitutional issues as well. Akhil Reed Amar, I feel like I buried my lead a little bit here in going through that very well done story on the history of the Constitution there. But let's now dive in to the connection of the institution of slavery to that.
And it connects just to Adams and Jefferson in just the way that we talked about. You set it up beautifully, Mitch, because you said, listen, do we have the Electoral College because they didn't believe in democracy? And I said, actually, no, they did believe in democracy. That's not the explanation. They put the Constitution to a vote, blah, 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 all the things I said before. No property qualifications for House or Senate or presidency, a direct election of the House of Representatives. No, that's not. And from an early stage, the state legislatures are choosing to let voters vote on the presidency. So that's not the explanation. And someone might say, well, is it a balance between big and small states? No. House versus Senate is a balance between big and small states, but not the Electoral College. The big state guy wins every time. For 8 of the first 9 elections, it's a Virginian, Washington, Jefferson, Madison, Monroe. That's the biggest state. We've only had 3 small state presidents in all of American history, Zachary Taylor, Franklin Pierce, Bill Clinton. So it's not a big state, small state thing. It's not that they don't believe in democracy. If James Carville were here, he'd say, it's slavery, stupid, and we can see it with Jefferson and Adams. Jefferson's a Southerner. He wins all the Southern states. Adams is a Northerner. He wins all the Northern states. America is not divided, big state against small state. Never has been. California and Texas and Florida and New York are the big states, and they don't have that much in common. America isn't divided, big state versus small state. Never has been. It's divided north against south, and coasts against the center, and cities against the backcountry, and that's today, and that's 200 years ago, and Jefferson Adams is north against south. And Jefferson wins the south twice, and Adams wins the north twice, and the swing state where North meets South, today that's called Ohio, or Virginia or North Carolina today, but back then it was New York, which, by the way, was a slave state. And the second time around, Jefferson wins New York. He loses the first time, but the second time he says, aha, I'm going to partner up with Burr, Aaron Burr. Burr's going to be able to deliver New York for me, and then I'll win. Okay, but here's now the key point. Jefferson wins that second time only because he's getting extra votes because of slavery. Remember how many electoral votes each state gets? It's based on 2 senators per state plus the number of seats in the House of Representatives. And how is that decided? By the free population plus 3/5 of the slave population. Mm. So slave states are getting a bonus. Extra slaves means extra seats in the House of Representatives, albeit at a 3/5 discount, means extra electoral votes. Who's the big winner? Can you spell Virginia? It's a slave state. It has fewer free people than Pennsylvania in 1800. Way fewer voters than Pennsylvania. Way more electoral votes than Pennsylvania. So the Electoral College is designed to give the South an inside track, because a direct election system would mean the South would lose every time because a huge proportion of its population are slaves who can't vote. But with an Electoral College, they get a bonus, and indeed, without the 13 or so extra electoral votes that Jefferson is getting because of slavery, because of the 3/5 clause, because his Southern states are being, their vote count is being padded in the Electoral College by slavery, by 3/5, without those extra votes because of slavery, electoral votes, Adams would have won even in 1800, and he knows it, and all the Northerners know it, all the Federalists know it, and they're every bit as ticked off as, let's say, we Democrats were after Bush versus Gore, because they saw this and they said, this sucks.
What was this laid out? Was this debated, this connection between, again, the Electoral College and the clause in the U.S. Constitution, not constitutional anymore, but it was at one time, that slaves would be counted as 3/5 of a human being. Well, was that connection debated at the 1787 convention? Constitutional convention?
It was indeed, but remember that conversation was held behind closed doors. It was secret, and we didn't have WikiLeaks. Hmm. We didn't have a hack into that. And so here's what happened. A Pennsylvanian named James Wilson, your audience may not have heard of James Wilson, but he's a very great man. He's a scholarship kid from Scotland. He's America's greatest lawyer. He's only one of 6 people to sign the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. He becomes a Supreme Court justice, and he's a small d Democrat. He believes in democracy. He uses the word over and over and over again. He believes in popular sovereignty. He believes that women should vote, believe it or not. He believes that the West should be equally treated, and he believes in direct election of the presidency, and he says so at Philadelphia. He says that's the most democratic and proper system. He is, you know, he's radical even by 21st century standards, and we haven't done justice to him. We haven't sort of talked about him enough. So he says it, and James Madison says in response from Virginia, you know, that's actually a pretty good idea in principle, but I've been doing the math, and here's the problem with it. If we have direct election of the presidency, the South will lose every single time because a huge proportion of our population are slaves. We have actually not so many voters. We have high property qualifications and lots of slavery. So the South isn't going to go for direct election, Mr. Wilson. How about if we create an electoral college system where we can count our slaves in some way, in the same way that we will count our slaves in determining how many seats each state gets in the House of Representatives? And that's all in Philadelphia, but it's secret. During the ratification process, many Americans, especially in the North, aren't focused on it. They don't get it. Oil people understand oil better than non-oil people, the oil companies. Big Pharma understands all the drug laws and the patent laws. Just so the slave power, the slaveholders understand the slavery and its economic interests way better than the Northerners do. So the Northerners don't quite realize just how pro-slavery a system they've bought themselves into. But everyone sees it in 1800, and with blinding clarity, boy, but for slavery, Adams would have won that election. Here's what the Northern newspapers say. This is a direct quote. Mr. Jefferson is riding into the executive mansion on the backs of his slaves. Mm. The executive mansion is what they called the White House back then. A great historian and scholar named Gary Wills has made this case very powerfully in a book on Thomas Jefferson. The book's title is called Negro President, because Jefferson was mockingly called that because people at the time understood, not maybe in 1787, but once Adams and Jefferson had squared off twice, Southerner against Northerner, then everyone understood basically the pro-slavery tilt of the Electoral College. And instead of getting rid of that altogether, we just tweaked the Electoral College by having a separate election for the vice presidency with the 12th Amendment. And we didn't get rid of the real problem, which is 3/5 in the pro-slavery bias.
And as you write, 32 years of the first 36 years we have a president are held by a president who is from the South and pro-slavery.
A plantation-owning Virginian for 8 of the first 9 elections. Every single president until Abraham Lincoln is basically, when president, a Southerner or what they called a Northern man of Southern sympathies, meaning someone who's not going to rock the boat too much on slavery. No president until Lincoln says the following while in the executive mansion. Slavery is wrong and we should eventually get rid of it. And you might say, oh, wait a minute, Professor, that's not right. I saw that movie Amistad and John Quincy Adams is old man eloquent against slavery. Yes, but when he was no longer president. When he was after his presidency, when he's merely a congressman from Massachusetts and appealing just to a Massachusetts electorate. When he was president, his vice president was a South Carolinian named John C. Calhoun. And his dad, when he was running for president, ran with other South Carolinians. You couldn't easily win the presidency early on if you basically thumbed your nose at the slaveocracy. You had to kiss its rear end, so to speak.
We finally got rid of the 3/5 clause, and we finally got rid of slavery. But why do you think we haven't gotten rid of the Electoral College?
In part because not everyone knows the story I've just told you. It's not the story that I grew up right outside of Berkeley, which is why I want us to do another interview sometime. You know, when I'm back in the Bay Area,
you're always welcome.
I love going back. But when I grew up in Walnut Creek, and when I was taught American history. They taught me it's because the framers didn't love democracy that much and it's a balance between big and small states. They taught me all the stories that we began with and that I dismissed. So one reason is most Americans even now don't really know about the origins of the Electoral College, its pro-slavery origins. A second reason is that many people think that you couldn't move to a direct election system without a constitutional amendment, and that's a really hard thing to do. In fact, as I explain actually in the new book, there are ways to move to a direct election system that wouldn't involve the very cumbersome process of a constitutional amendment, which requires 2/3 of the House, 2/3 of the Senate, 3/4 of the states, which is a very hard thing to do.
Again, we are in conversation with Akhil Reed Amar. He is the Sterling Professor of Law and Political Science at Yale University. He is the author of the book, The Constitution Today, Timeless Lessons for the Issues of Our Era. He joins us from the Yale Broadcast Center in New Haven, Connecticut. And we do want to take your calls. Folks who are listening, if you have your questions or comments. Akhil Reed Amar, speaking of voter suppression, and this is another aspect I never really thought a lot about concerning the Electoral College beyond the connection to slavery, is that you argue it also is very much suppresses the vote today.
Yeah, it eliminates the incentive that might otherwise exist to make it easy to vote. Now, truthfully, it's not a perfect incentive because we live in a world in which one party tends to benefit from low voter turnout and the other party tends to benefit from high voter turnout, and you know which parties I'm talking about. But from just an abstract point of view, if you believe actually just in promoting your state's interest in the national conversation, well, in a direct election world, if more Ohioans vote, well, then Ohio's playing a bigger role in national conversation, and you'd want to make it easy for Ohioans to vote if you're a good government person from Ohio. But in an electoral college system, it doesn't matter whether a lot of Ohioans vote or a few Ohioans vote. Ohio gets the same number of electoral votes either way. Think about in 1910, let's say. Some states are letting women vote. Others aren't. Well, in a direct election alternative universe, any state that let women vote would double its clout automatically. California, just by letting women vote, would be twice as weighty as otherwise. And in a direct election world, I believe there actually would be good incentives for states to actually facilitate voting in all sorts of ways. We could have states experiment in some ways. One state could have early voting, and one state could have same-day registration, and another state could say, we're going to make voting a national state holiday. And another state could say, we're going to require employers to give their workers 3 hours off to get to the polls. Different states could try different things, but states would have an incentive to maximize turnout. That might be complicated by party incentives, political party incentives, but in principle, states might want to maximize voter participation from their state so that their state would actually be playing a bigger role in the national tally.
There are states all with Republican legislatures and probably Republican governors that have in the last few years adopted voting ID laws and these type of things. If they know their electoral college vote that's going to go towards the presidency is locked, regardless of how many people
vote.
Exactly. If there wasn't the electoral college vote, there would actually be a disincentive for them to enact these type of laws.
And good government reformers who aren't either Democrats or Republicans would just say, wait a minute, the League of Women Voters, folks like that would say, wait a minute, why are you adopting these laws that actually are hurting our state's interest?
Let's go to our first caller, Kazoo in Oakland. Good morning, Kazoo. You are on the air with Akhil Reed Amar.
Hi, thanks for having me. Quick question. So as an activist on the ground who cares very much about having a democracy, what are some suggestions you would have for us in terms of moving forward as activists to push for actual direct democracy and the removal of the electoral colleges?
In terms of a direct presidential election, a bunch of states have already adopted an interesting reform that if other states join the bandwagon, could give us a direct election system. It's called the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, and here's how it works. California today gives all of its electoral votes to the person who wins California. But California could, and indeed California legislature has, passed a law saying if enough other states join the bandwagon, we in California will give our electoral votes, our state electoral votes, to the person who wins the national popular vote, not the person who wins the California vote. And California said we will do that if enough other states actually join the bandwagon. And about 10 states or 11 states have actually joined the bandwagon. Together, they don't add up to 270 electoral votes, and the system won't go into an effect until the states that have joined this collectivity add up to 270 electoral votes. But if they do, then whoever wins the national popular vote will win the electoral votes for all of those states, and that will, by hypothesis, by stipulation, add up to 270, which is all you need to win, and then the game becomes winning the national popular vote. It's a very interesting and edgy idea. Here's the kick in the head. It's an idea that actually grows in part out of something that I posted on a website in 2001. I had an idea like this, and there's a fellow named Robert Bennett, the dean at Northwestern Law School, who had a similar idea at the same time, and we independently sort of posted these ideas, and someone actually sort of read them and said, hey, maybe we should implement that. So Governor Brown actually did sign a law that California is actually part of this reform package. So there are ways of improvising toward a direct national election system, even without the constitutional amendment. But your Kazoo's broader question, just forget the presidential electoral college system for just a second. You know, what can we do to promote democracy? Here's what we can do. We can insist that the Voting Rights Act of 1965 be revived. The Supreme Court invalidated one key portion of that. We can oppose all sorts of voter ID laws that are mainly not designed really to prevent fraud, but really are designed to suppress the vote. There are all sorts of laws that have been passed in state after state that are really designed to make it hard to vote. We should crusade everywhere for regimes that make it easier to vote. For example, automatic registration when you're in high school, when you hit 18, you're automatically signed up. Or when you go to the DMV, you're automatically signed up. Ways to actually encourage people to vote, make it easier for people to vote, rather than to make it hard for people to vote.
Is there a fine line for you between direct democracy and representative democracy?
Yes. Direct democracy isn't always the best thing. You know, I grew up in California, and I think referenda and initiatives have their place, but they aren't always the best way of governing on every issue. Even California has a balance between the laws passed through the representative process and the laws passed by direct democracy mechanisms. And I think it would be a mistake to basically try to do everything through initiative and referenda. And one problem with initiative and referenda is if the ballots become too complicated, they're just too many issues on a standard ballot, that can overload the informational capacities of the ordinary voter. And then, yeah, you're getting a lot of people involved, but are they really thinking about the issues in the way that you want?
Let's go to Caroline, who is in Oakland. Good morning, Caroline. You're on the air with Akhil Reed Amar.
Good morning. You know, I apologize. I actually caught just a little part of your show talking about electoral colleges. Could you please explain the difference between a popular vote and what the electoral college vote means when choosing the winner? For example, even though they win the popular vote, they still win if they have more electoral votes. Could you just please explain the difference?
I mean, she's pretty much getting to the 2000 election, I believe.
Exactly so. So in 2000, Al Gore got about 500,000 more votes nationwide, but his votes were distributed in such a way that he didn't win enough states. And in particular, he didn't win Florida. He also didn't win his home state of Tennessee, and he didn't win New Hampshire yet. He didn't win a bunch of so even though he won more states nationwide, nationwide, he didn't win 270 electoral votes, which is what he needed. Now, one question is the Electoral College skewed against the Democratic Party today? No, I don't think it is. Yes, in 2000, it helped Bush and hurt Gore, but if the weather had been different on election day, there had been a storm in one part of the country and better weather, I could have imagined, you know, even in that election, Al Gore winning the Electoral College while losing the popular vote. So that the inversion could have happened either way. In this year's election, Hillary Clinton may be benefiting from the fact that she has more pathways to 270 because there are just more permutations and combinations of states that she could win. Trump basically has to win all the swing states, and Clinton has to win like any of them, in effect, the toss-up states. So the Electoral College, to my mind today, is not skewed against either party, but it does deviate from the deep constitutional principle of one person, one vote, which is how we pick governors, for example, how we pick senators. You know, governors are like presidents. They serve typically four-year terms. They have veto pens. They have pardon pens. No state has an electoral college to pick its governor. Here's how we do it in California. Everyone votes, one person, one vote, and if it's really close, we count them up, and if it's really close, we recount them carefully. Call us crazy, but that's how we do it in California. But actually, I'm joking, because that's how we do it in Texas, and that's how we do it in Connecticut and every other state. We could do that for the presidency, too, and the ideal that would be vindicated is the idea of equality. One person, one vote. All votes are counted equally. By the way, here's why the current system isn't really skewed too much one way or another. Republicans tend to win more states overall, especially big boxy states in the middle of the country where no one lives, like Wyoming.
We all see the map, Montana. The electoral map.
Right.
And it's almost all red, yet still the Democrats
by lead. By landmass.
Yeah.
So, and every state gets automatically three electoral votes, even if it's low population. Even though Wyoming actually has fewer people than some counties in California, but they get automatically three electoral votes because every state gets two electoral votes based on its two senators. Republicans win more of those states and get the extra two senator per state bonus, and so that pads their count. On the other hand, we Democrats tend to win more of the most populous states. And because of winner take all, that's a big bonus if we win California and New York and maybe Florida. Or even if we don't win Florida, you know, we win Illinois and Pennsylvania. And so we tend to win, let's say, 7 out of the 10 big states, and winner take all really sort of gives us a bit of a boost. We Democrats and the Republicans win more states overall, and they get a boost because they're two senators for each state, even a small one. And in today's world, those two offsetting biases tend to sort of roughly even out.
So you don't think our election of senators and the way we have senators, each state has two of them, falls short in the pro-democracy arena the same way the Electoral College does, considering
it does. And I'm a Californian by, you know, by heart, and I grew up, and it never seemed fair to me as a Californian that there's 70 Californians for every Wyomingian or Wyomingite, and yet Wyoming has two senators and California has two senators. That didn't seem fair to me. On the other hand, one, at least the Senate is not malapportioned in some aristocratic way. And the malapportionment that does exist in the Senate tends to cancel out in interesting ways. Here's one way to put it. There doesn't tend to be that much of a systemic skew or bias. It's not as if one party is hugely benefited. Here's a way to put it. Obama beat Romney by 4 points nationally in 2012. And yet, he lost a majority of congressional House districts. You see, the House looks fairer. It's proportionate. But even though Obama won a majority of the national population, Romney won a majority of congressional districts, and even though nationally way more people voted for Democrats than Republicans for the House of Representatives, actually in 2012, the Republicans controlled the House of Representatives. In theory, the House looks better, but there's because of the way district lines are drawn, partly through gerrymandering, but partly actually through where ordinary citizens choose to congregate, Democrats tend to cluster in cities. Although the House in theory looks better, it's actually skewed. Which House of Congress more closely approximated in 2012 the national vote balance? It was actually the Senate, because the Democrats controlled a majority of the Senate after 2012, even though the Republicans controlled a majority of the House, and the Democrats had won national congressional majorities and national presidential majorities. So in theory, the Senate looks bad and the House looks better, but in practice, things are more complicated. So I don't love the Senate. I think it's wrong in principle, but in practice, it's not so bad.
Before we get back to the callers, I got a couple of emails, and we're not actually soliciting emails, but you know, when people are really into the guest, they'll find any way to get their question to you. This is from Miss Regina. It says, your guest today mentioned that automatic sign up at DMV, but not all people who get driver licenses are citizens. That won't work. I guess we're talking about the register to vote.
Yeah, so you at the DMV, you're asked to show your papers, your birth certificate, your passport, and the like. So when you go to the DMV, what I'm saying is you're already in a line. It's a hassle. It's a government bureaucracy. Why should you have to go to a separate line to register to vote? Why not one-stop shopping while you're there? If you are eligible to vote, they just sign you up automatically. Remember, I said we should even do it in high school. And, of course, not everyone in high school is going to be eligible because not everyone is a citizen. But why not basically make the paperwork easy to do? I'll give you an example. There are lots of things that I love about California. When I was in California, they actually sent me the ballot, and I could study it before election day. And they told me, you know, here's the election day, here's your polling place, you know, here are the polling hours, you have to show up, you know, here's the ballot, you can study it. I'm in Connecticut now. God forbid that they should even tell me when election day is or where it is, you know, it's the third rock past the second tree, and you just have to know that because you've lived here forever or something. I moved towns in Connecticut. And I get this nice letter from my new town saying, welcome to Woodbridge. Here are your taxes. Fine. But then, you know, the tax office knows that I've moved to Woodbridge, but the voting office doesn't. They make me register again. I'm thinking, wait a minute. One, I pay you guys. You work for me. You're making it hard for me to vote. Your tax office knows that I've moved from North Haven to Woodbridge. Why doesn't your voting office know that? Why do I have to stand in the second line? Yeah, and so what I am saying is there are ways to make it easier for people to vote.
Akhil Reed Amar, I want to thank you greatly.
Thank you, Mitch.